people are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
This is the story of how an eccentric environmental scare grew into a powerful global industry.
It's a wonderful business opportunity, okay? You want climate, we'll give you climate.
Sandy Rios with you. That's what we're going to talk about today. And you heard, of course, in the opening, that was the voice of Greta Thunberg, who said young Swedish activist, oh, maybe not so young now, but she started out when she was quite young. And you can hear, I think when Greta first started out, she was seriously just worried sick because she had been taught that the Earth was going to end. I think it was in 12 years then. And she was so upset, she started speaking out, and they used her. I think the movement used her. I don't know. I think she's still part of it, and I think she's actually benefited greatly financially. So I don't know if she still believes what she was opining about in that statement, or if she's now playing the game. I don't know, but we're going to talk today about the environmental movement. We're going to talk about a book called The Case for Realism on Climate and Energy. It's fascinating, and the discussion is so interesting, so that I hope you'll stay tuned. Well, one of the things that we know about the environmental movement, it really is very much anti-human. Humans don't matter. In fact, humans are the ones causing this destruction of the Earth, according to their narrative. And so it's just, it's the opposite worldview, really, of followers of Christ. It really is the opposite, because God has told us that human life is precious. And so that's why we talk about abortion. That's why environmentalists, I don't think, are too keen. They're not so involved in saving babies' lives, at least not the hardcore ones. And that's because of their view of the world. And our view of the world says that babies matter, an innocent life matters, an unborn innocent life matters. You know, President Biden has vowed to restore Roe versus Wade as the law of the land. And we remember that there were 65 babies who have already been sacrificed in the name of abortion. I'm not sure how much longer God is going to take this, how much longer he's going to stand by before he brings judgment to us, really. And that's, you know, we want to save babies not to prevent judgment on us, although that would be nice. We want to do that because it's right, and we know it's the heart of God. $28 buys one ultrasound, or provides one ultrasound, for a mom who's found herself pregnant, and it's a bad time. She's embarrassed, whatever the problem is. Economically, it's difficult. She's starting school. I don't know. Fill in the blanks. And $28 provides an ultrasound where that woman, that mom-to-be, can see her baby in the womb and see its characteristics, hear its heartbeat. It's amazing. And when that happens, most of them decide to keep their babies, or at least to let them live. Even if they adopt them out, that's great, a great option. And so if you'd like to help Preborn provide those ultrasounds, it's $28 for one of them. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy and make your best donation. And by the way, thank you for those great messages that you've been leaving. It's 662-821-2040 if you would like to leave us a message that we can respond to. You can write us at sandy@afr.net, sandy@afr.net. You can listen to the podcast on any platform that you're accustomed to. AFR.net is our home base. That's American Family Radio, and that's where I got my roots, and that's who I still work with. And so that's where you can find the show. You can also find it at my website, sandyrios.com. That's an easy way to listen as well. Try to make it easy so that you can listen and so that you can tell others about the show, because we are really having the privilege. I was just thinking, this weekend, when I sat down to record the Easter show, or last week, I just thought to myself, what a great privilege it is for me to still be able to do this, to, in the case of Easter, to proclaim the glory of God, the resurrection. What a joy. And also to talk to people like our guests today, because they are brilliant men, and they have a lot to say to us and a lot to teach us. It's a great privilege, and I hope that you enjoy these podcasts, and I hope that you'll share it with your friends so we can have more of an impact, even more of an impact in these troubled times. Well, sit back and relax And maybe not enjoy, maybe bring a piece of paper and pencil, because this is one you'll want to take notes on. The Case of Realism, Climate and Energy, on this edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness. That we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
We called it industrial progress. Since the Industrial Revolution, the development of free market capitalist mass production has made ever more goods, ever more affordable, to ever larger numbers of people. Mass production marched hand in hand with mass consumption. In the modern age, ordinary people enjoy a level of prosperity never before achieved in human history. But all the while, we are told we were destroying the planet. Computers have calculated what is in store for us as we produce and consume ever more. The weather will get worse. The planet will boil. We greedy humans must accept limits on our lifestyle. Consume less, travel less. Those who deny the climate crisis are not just wrong, they're dangerous, spreading the poison of doubt among a gullible population. These deniers should be shunned and shamed and censored. For these climate deniers are flat earthers. They are anti-science.
All right, Sandy Rios with you, and that's our topic today. That's from the movie Climate, the movie, and The Cold Truth, and that's published by Daily Signal and Heritage. And ironically, our next guest, at least one of our next guests, has been honored by Heritage for his work on this issue. He's the author of a brand new book, or the editor, and you'll understand that in just a second, and it's called Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. I think that's a great name, and Dr. Cal Beisner joins us this morning. He's the founder and president of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And this is a network of Christian theologians, scientists, economists, and other scholars. And for a long time, when I first met Cal, he was an associate professor. And because of his courage, things went south there, as they have for many other truth speakers and academics. He's written over 15 books. He's published thousands of articles and testified on the ethics and economics of climate change before both the U.S. Senate and the House. He's also briefed the White House Council on environmental policy. And so that's a great introduction. I didn't write it, but that does explain Cal's work. And Cal, thank you for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Sandy, very, very much.
Now, this is an interesting, you say, you know, you describe yourself as an editor for a reason. Explain kind of the nuts of and bolts of this particular book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Why do you call yourself just an editor?
Well, yeah, David and I both, David LeGates and I both, were editors of this book. That's because we have a total of 16 different scholars who have contributed to this book. 9 climate scientists, one fellow who's both a climate scientist and an environmental economist, another fellow who's a climate scientist and an energy management specialist. Then we have a couple of other economists and a couple of other energy experts. So, you know, a great collection of scholars contributed to this book so that we're able to not just the debates over, okay, what does scientific evidence tell us about how much warming comes when we add a little CO2 to the atmosphere, or you know, how sea level will be affected or anything like that, but also the very important questions like, okay, if we're going to try to switch from coal, oil, and natural gas to wind and solar and other so-called renewable energy sources, what will that do to the world's economy? What will it do to the poor in developed countries and to pretty much everybody in undeveloped and developing countries? So we try to cover the whole spectrum. I think it's a great book. It opened at number 1 and number 2 in environmental and energy policy on Amazon, and So we're pretty proud, pretty pleased with what's happened with this.
Well, it's so timely, and we're going to get into some of that timeliness, but your partner here, your co-editor is Dr. David, it's Legates. I was going to say Legatus, because I like that, Legatus, but it's Legates, right, David?
Yes, that is Legates.
Okay. Dr. Legates is with the Cornwall Alliance also. He is a former professor emeritus at the University, or he is currently professor emeritus at the University of Delaware. His PhD is in climatology. He was also the executive director of the Global Change Research Project under President Trump. And so that's just something of his past. I would be really interested, Dr. Legates, on your climatologist, and you edited this with Cal. There must be a story here of how you made this transition, because it can't have been popular at the University of Delaware to hold the opinions that you were going to hear that you hold. So what happened? Did something happen there?
Well, it wasn't positive. It was early on, and then, as you probably guess, most universities have gone woke and gone to the extreme leftist side. It just became untenable for me to stay there. And so they had a good retirement plan, and I took it and decided to work with Cal, and I've never looked back. I started out in the 1970s when it was global cooling. I got involved in climate because of climate change. That's going to be the big thing in the 1980s and beyond, I was told. At one point I was attending meetings with some of the very alarmists that, we could list on the record, and just simply sitting down looking at the data, it became clear that there's just nothing there, that it didn't all add up. And so I rejected the what so-called consensus argument, which isn't a consensus at all, but I rejected that and, paid the price for it.
Yes, but wait a second, because, David, the experts tell us that all scientists embrace this. All scientists embrace climate change. They've got lists and lists of their names on these statements. So what's happening here? Why is that not true?
See, that's the argument, is when you ask the question, do you believe in climate change? Most scientists will say yes, and that's a correct answer, because climate changes, climate always has changed, and climate always will change. The question that's not asked by that is, do you believe that climate change is developed by humans? Do you believe it will be disastrous? And do you believe that we've got to gut our economy in order to save us from this mythical beast called global warming? That's not the question that most people ask. And if you ask that question of many scientists, you'll find, as the American Meteorological Society did, you'll find that effectively about half of the people are true believers and half of the people we'll call realists. And that's part of what we want to get across through the book, is that the science is clearly not settled. Science is never settled, but particularly with respect to climate change, the science is not settled. And that scientists generally disagree completely on whether humans are a disastrous effect on the climate or whether they aren't.
You know, I want to ask you one more question before I go back to Cal. What do you think, there's a lot of choices here, but what do you think the greatest lie that people have been persuaded to believe is on climate or energy? What's the biggest lie, the biggest, most successful lie that they've told?
Well, partially I would say it's the 97% consensus, because somehow if everybody agrees, then we all go along with it. But in reality, I think it's the idea that the renewable energies are in fact clean and green, bring us energy without reservation. I mean, when you look closely at how the materials are produced to get the wind turbines, to get the solar panels, they are neither environmentally friendly nor are they socially just. I mean, we essentially use processes such as strip mining to go in and just destroy all the land so we can use toxic materials to extract these materials. And then they, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example, they send in child labor. And in Southeast Asia, they send in people that are enslaved. So
it's not clean. It's not green. At the end of the day, it produces probably more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to extract this stuff than it will ever save by the life of a wind turbine or the life of a solar panel. So that's my argument as to the biggest lie that's going on.
Yeah. Cal, I forgot until I read this morning, reread, that you grew up in Calcutta, India. And as I understand, that was part, I don't remember this. You and I have talked so many times through the years, and I had forgotten. And that kind of was the heart of this. You are I would say a theologian. I don't know if you'd take that description. I think you are a theologian of climate and the soul of man and God's part in this. Why did Calcutta kind of awaken you to this work that you do now? What happened?
As a little child, when my dad was working with the U.S. State Department in Calcutta, India, I observed two things that stuck with me ever after that, basically through picture memories in my mind. One was just the beauty of God's creation, but the other was the horrors of extreme poverty. For a time, my mother was paralyzed with disease, and so every day I would be walked to the home of an Indian family where I would spend the day. And we were out early in the morning for that walk. And all along the way, I would step over the bodies of people who had died overnight of starvation and disease. Now, I wasn't a Christian at the time. My parents weren't. But later on, we all became Christians. And as I grew as a Christian and began to understand what the Bible said, both about the beauty of God's creation and our responsibility to take good care of it and to develop it, to improve it, and so on, and what the Bible says about our duty toward the poor, the more I realized that from those very early experiences, God had provided some motivation for me to get down into the weeds, so to speak, on what really does help the poor in this world and what really does harm the creation and how we can protect and conserve and steward the creation in a godly way. So all of that led eventually by writing several different books in the field after doing a great deal of research, and have continued to do research in all the, you know, three and a half decades since that stuff started. And it's been exciting work for me because it really is a situation where the Christian church, I believe, has much to say that is relevant to these things, both through our recognition that science itself as a project works only if we live in a rationally ordered creation that we can understand because we're given minds made in God's image to think the way God thinks. And then also because God calls us in Genesis 1:28 to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over everything in it. And what that means is that we need to figure out what that actually involves. How do we do that? Is that a license for us to just kind of rape the planet? No, it's for us to exercise the image of God, who made everything out of nothing, brought light out of darkness, order out of chaos, and life out of non-life. Well, we should be doing the same kind of thing, enhancing the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors, so that we're addressing the two great commandments, to love God and to love neighbor.
Okay, so I want to just restate the name of what you founded. Has it been 20 years? Has it been 20 years since you founded Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation? Seems like it might have been.
19 years in August.
Okay, all right, so I'm pretty much on. The Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, thus the name, and this book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, and Christians Must Live in the Real World. Now, I'm going to ask you a practical question that relates, I think, to where your interest is. You're interested in all of it, but a mutual friend, I'm sure you probably know, or if you don't know him, you've heard of him, Dr. Erwin Lutzer is a very good friend of mine. He's been in Albania.
Sure.
He said, actually, he may be there now, thereabouts this time. And he talked to me recently and said that he had met several politicians the last time he was there. He was there preaching, but he also met leaders, people that were running for office, people that were in office. Mm-hmm. He was on national television. And he met one of these leaders, and Dr. Lutzer just asked him, well, tell me, what is your platform? What are you running on for this position? And the man said, we must do away with wood-burning stoves. That's what we use, and we have to. We're hurting the climate. And I didn't say this area of Albania was so poor. People were so poor and so hungry. And so I'm just going to ask you, Cal, why this attack on wood-burning stoves? It just brings some reality to that subject, if you could.
Yeah, you know, the big problem with wood-burning stoves is not how much carbon dioxide they put into the atmosphere. It's how much particulate pollution they put. Smoke, right? Right there where you're burning this wood. How much particulate pollution they put into the air that people breathe in, and that gives them all kinds of lung diseases and upper respiratory diseases and so on. I mean, that's a problem. And, you know, Sandy, it raises an interesting thing here. People tell us how we need to move from coal, oil, and natural gas to so-called renewable energy. Well, right now, coal, oil, natural gas, nuclear, and hydro, major size hydro, provide about 95% of all the energy that we use in the world. Renewables provide only about the remaining 5%. Of those renewables, wood and dried dung produce about half of the energy that we use, and
wow.
Those are filthy, and they kill people. Wind turbines and solar panels together provide only about half of that remaining 5%, and those, as David just pointed out, are filthy themselves in how they are made. So they're not clean, green energy. And what needs to happen in a place like Albania is to get away from biofuels like wood and dung, right, that are so common, but not to wind and solar, which are very expensive and low density and intermittent and unpredictable, therefore unreliable, but rather to energy produced from electricity, from coal and natural gas, and the Lord willing, soon enough, nuclear, which would be absolutely wonderful there in Albania, and transport fuel from oil and oil products. This is what will lift people out of poverty. You know, the history of economics tells us that two things are indispensable to lift and keep a whole society out of poverty. One is a set of social institutions, property rights, private enterprise, entrepreneurship, free trade, limited government, the rule of law. The other is access to abundant, affordable, reliable energy. And the most abundant, affordable, reliable energy sources we have are the coal, oil, and natural gas that people are blaming for global warming. But the global warming is, frankly, not a significant problem. You know, you heard Richard Attenborough on that clip that you played early on from one of his documentaries saying that the planet would be boiling. Huh? The boiling point of water is 212 degrees Fahrenheit. We're talking about global warming raising global average temperature from maybe about 59 degrees Fahrenheit to maybe about 60 or 61 degrees Fahrenheit. That's not boiling. That kind of language is utterly irresponsible. It's designed to make people panic so that they don't think carefully about policies that are going to affect billions of people.
Before you both joined me, I played a clip of Greta Thunberg, talking about the desperation, the world is going to be destroyed. And so, David, I want to ask you, because you're a professor, it seems to me, and this is going down into the grade schools, you know, even frightening kids, giving them fear, discouraging them, dampening their spirit. Am I overstating? I don't have kids in school anymore, so I really don't know, except I see a desperation among young people that I think is in part because of what they're being told about the future regarding climate.
No, you're not. I used to ask my class how many times they had seen an inconvenient truth, and it was always 5 or 6 times. They would get it in history class. They would get it in science class. They would get it in literary writing class. They would just keep going back and forth over and over. And now, yeah, Greta Thunberg is out making these wild statements. And I think you're exactly right. The argument that comes along with it is that there is desperation, that the world that we're leaving you is going to be in peril. There's complete disaster. And for kids that, you know, haven't been around a lot, don't understand how this really works, they become scared that their future isn't there, that they're going to live in some oddball dystopian society, and they might very well live that way. It's just going to be for completely different reasons. And so I think you're right that this is exactly what children are being told, so that we can bring up a group of people that think the world's coming to an end and therefore will go along with all of the processes they want them to go along with.
Well, they're also being told that it's their fault. It's our fault.
Of course.
So that brings me to the question, global warming. Of course, we used to be climate change. Are humans responsible in any way for climate change?
We are on a local scale. I mean, we have such things, for example, as the urban heat island effect. I mean, if you look at local nightly weather, you'll see that generally on a night where there's nothing happening, that Center City, Memphis, or Washington, D.C. will be warmer, for example, than the surrounding countryside, and that's due to the fact that there's a city there. So it does change the local environment. I mean, to say that humans have no effect on climate is not real, but to say that humans have an effect on global climate that is changing our temperature to the point at which we get more floods, more droughts, more hurricanes, more tornadoes. I mean, that was the same argument we would get with global cooling. The cooler world would get more hurricanes, more floods, more droughts, more of everything evil. And now apparently warming does the same thing. And unless we're sitting on some sort of saddle point, one of those two arguments has to be wrong. And the argument generally is that a warmer world is a better world for humans. It actually is a less violent world because of the equator to pole temperature gradient. I won't get off into the science on all this, but generally speaking, warmer temperatures are far better for civilization than colder temperatures.
You know, ever since I have been a kid, there is always some climate disaster. You know, there's the rainforest, and we're going to run out of oil. I remember hearing that in school. We're running out of oil, you know. There's a finite amount of it, and we're using too much of it. I mean, there was always a scare then, as you said. There's, you know, climate change, global warming. They always have a new name. And one other thing, David, when I've traveled around the world, which I have, occasionally, I remember being in a remote place in Thailand in a hotel with geckos crawling all over my walls, but they still had CNN. I'm watching CNN International. Anyway, and they're talking about every story is a disaster for crops, for plants. This is a long time ago. Every story was disaster. What is there to gain? I mean, is that, first of all, I'm assuming that's not true. So maybe it's true. There's disaster everywhere. But secondly, why? What's the motive? Why would they do that? Why would CNN International, for instance, get such a kick out of constantly reporting disaster?
There's something about human psychology that is especially interested in bad news. That's why you get bad news on the front page of the newspaper, or, you know, in your earliest parts of your internet broadcasts and so on. You get bad news there. Good news hardly gets reported at all. And there's a simple rule for that. Journalists will tell you bad news is good news. Good news is no news. Why? Because bad news attracts eyeballs, and eyeballs are of consumers, and consumers see the advertising that pays for putting the news in front of us. That's the real case. The fact is, there's a whole lot more good news going on all the time than there is bad news, but it's not profitable for mainstream media to report it.
Well, that's an interesting, that, I mean, that's a on its face, that's an on its face explanation. But David, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about that. Do you think there was something else going on here?
We've always had disasters, and there's a saying that goes around: never let a good disaster go to waste. So the idea is, if a hurricane hits in July or August along the Florida coast, we're going to pretend that that's due to climate change. And the reason for all this is, I think, power and control. One of the things that allows you to be free is inexpensive energy. And if we can get, I mean, this is effectively what took us from
in the early 1800s, when about 10% of the population of the planet was above the poverty line, to 2020, when about 90% of the world's population is above the poverty line. That should be something to celebrate. What caused that was the availability of inexpensive energy, cheap energy. And that pulls people up out of poverty. But what they want to do somehow is to make energy more expensive, because with cheap energy, with the understanding, with the communications, with the ability to travel, you learn things about the world. And what they would rather have you do is be spoon-fed what they want you to know, and you can't do that if you have lots of energy so that you can travel and communicate. What they would prefer you to do is sit in an isolated area and not know what's going on. I had a friend of mine that escaped from Bratislava, and we were in Moscow just before the Soviet Union fell. And he said, you know, we always believed that things were bad here in Bratislava, but over the next hill it was a little bit better, and over the next hill it was a little bit better than that. And by the time we got to Moscow, they were living high on the hog, and we just had to wait for that to trickle down to us. He said the people living in Moscow right now are worse off than we were in Bratislava in the early 60s. And that's part of the idea, is if you don't know what's going on, you don't understand the philosophy. If you can move around, if you can communicate, you learn what's really happening, and you can adjust to it. And totalitarians just don't like free thinkers.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
As you're listening to this podcast, and again, Sandy Rios, and I want to thank you so much for listening. If you have the means, I wonder if you would consider a leadership gift to saving babies with preborn in a bigger way. It's a tax-deductible donation, and one of $5,000, for instance, would sponsor preborn's entire network for 24 hours. And that usually saves the average of 200 babies. I mean, that's amazing, isn't it, when you think about how that money would be spent. And they do have an incredible track record of saving babies. To donate, all you have to do is go to preborn.com/Sandy. And, of course, if that's too much money for you, $28 provides one ultrasound. So whatever you can afford, go to preborn.com/Sandy. Hi, this is Sandy Rios, and I miss you in the mornings. But now I'm hosting a podcast, Sandy Rios 24/7, which is available at AFR.net and SandyRios.com. Well, I finally finished that book. God's Velvet Hammer chronicles God's call in my life, from a small town girl to Berlin, Germany, Radio Moscow to North Korea to Washington, D.C. I talk about Sasha Girl. It was my disabled daughter. I talk about I've Got the Music in Me. That's a chapter on my music life. Lost in India and Other Adventures is hilarious. You won't want to miss it. I talk about my sweetheart, The Blessing of Bruce. And then a mysterious chapter called My Green Face and the End of It All. Oh, I think you'll enjoy it. Like the Apostle Paul, these are my shipwrecks and my adventures. All for Christ and His kingdom. God's Velvet Hammer is available wherever books are sold. And remember, Sandy Rios 24/7 is available at AFR.net and SandyRios.com.
This is a story of the corruption of science.
There's no such thing as a climate emergency happening on this planet now. There's no evidence of one.
The climate alarm is nonsense, you know, it's a hoax. I've never liked hoax. I think scam is a better word, but I'm willing to live with hoax.
It's a story about the bullying and intimidation of anyone who dares to challenge the climate alarm.
To speak up against or about climate change in any sort of skeptical way was essentially career suicide.
Activists are even calling for any skepticism to be criminalized.
It's the story of an assault on individual freedom.
It's a wonderful way to increase government power. If there's an existential threat out there that's worldwide, well, you need a powerful worldwide government, you know, to cope with it.
We see all these kind of authoritarian measures being adopted in the name of saving the planet.
You've suddenly got the population under control all over the world.
Sandy Rios, back with you. Well, that's from Climate... The movie, The Cold Truth, published again by Heritage and the Daily Wire. It's just great. And we're drawing our sound from them today for this show about the book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Just a couple of things that we didn't get to that I'll mention. It's affecting us all right now. I think about that, their attempt to do away with gas stoves. And now their attempt, of course, to do with gas-powered cars and trucks. It's really imminently on us, and it's become very foolish and very frightening. And just to bring some sobriety to this, even if America stopped emitting carbon overnight, global temperatures would decline by less than 0.2 of a degree Celsius by the year 2100. And that's according to the government models. They tell us that hurricanes are worsening. But despite the headlines about that, the data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration shows no long-term increase in the frequency of intensity of U.S. hurricanes since records began being kept in the mid-1800s. And then one more fact. The climate models have consistently overestimated warming, running 43% hotter than actual observations over the past 50 years. Just to give you an idea of what we're dealing with. Well, it's time for Bruce to join me, my sweetheart Bruce, who's a former FBI agent. And of course, when we first met, this has been a hot topic for a long time. I remember we were in we were in New York City at a dining, and we sat next to some Russians, and they started waxing eloquent about global warming, as I believe at the time. And I got in kind of a, not an altercation, but a heavy discussion about that. And Bruce, this was new to Bruce, that I felt he was learning, you know, different subjects that I'd been talking about. And we had a difference of agreement about the level of this or the severity of it. But you see things differently now, don't you, sweetheart?
I do. At the time, that was probably around, 2010 maybe. I've never been a believer in climate change is going to ruin the world. But I have been a believer in we have to be careful in how we deal with pollution, things like that, because we can hurt the environment, which would hurt people. I think that is still true, but not to the degree that people would have us believe. We have to remember, as Christians, we believe in the sovereignty of God, and we believe in His creation. And really, it's the height of hubris for us to think that by either burning gas or burning wood or burning
cars.
Yeah, we are going to change God's creation to the point of it will be ruined.
It's kind of atmospheric. You know, I think the whole idea of pollution way back, and then where they put those, I remember being a skeptic about that, about the things they put on cars.
Catalytic converters.
Mm-hmm. And I remember my dad grousing about that, too. But we can see that that was a good thing. I mean, That actually did clear up the atmosphere as far as we can see on the Earth.
Having lived in Los Angeles for 8 years, I can tell you all about smog. And it's a real dilemma. Is it going to destroy the planet?
Right.
Change
the weather. I mean, that's what we can't do.
Yeah.
We can affect the atmosphere. We can burn a fire and affect the atmosphere near us, but we can't change hurricanes.
Well, what I found really interesting about what these gentlemen were speaking about is when they talked about the percentages of the use of fuels in the world, and that only 5% of the fuels right now are renewable energy. Think about that. Think about the money that these environmentalist groups want to throw at this quote-unquote problem when we really don't have a demonstrable problem to me. I mean, a lot of this is made up. And even if you threw all this money into these renewable sources, solar, wind, it's not going to affect what goes on in the planet because, as you've seen, you can go to electric cars and they have to be powered by energy that is made from fossil fuels. They talked about how these electric cars are here and they destroy the roads and those have to be repaired by machinery with fossil fuels. I think this is just absolutely ridiculous to talk about. We have to worry about that people are burning wood stoves. I mean, I'll tell you where I saw this up close and personal was around 2008. I went to Afghanistan on behalf of the FBI
and I was billeted in the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. And I noticed it was set in kind of a depression with mountains around it. And I noticed that there was like a grayish or brownish film all over everything as you walked around. And so I asked somebody what it was, and they said, well, wait till the evening and look up. So at night, you would see campfires burning all around the perimeter of that depression, and it was the local people, and what they were doing is they're burning dung in their fires. That's how they fired that's how they built their fires, and that's how they cooked, and that's how they stayed warm. And this residue settled down. So, yeah, does it create a problem? Yes, it does. But does it create the end of the world? No, it does not. And would we be better off going to a more efficient fuel system?
Like electricity or even, you know, a gasoline-powered heater or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it makes no sense at all what is being proposed by these environmentalists. You know, going to that kind of a system is not going to help. It's going to increase disease and bankrupt us, really.
Yeah, really, yes. But, well, that's why they call their book The Case for Realism. Let's get real here. Let's get real here. I mean, they're spending thousands and thousands of dollars. There was an article, Bruce, in the New York Times this morning. It's called Engineering Change, Infusing Clouds with Sulfur Dioxide to Block the Sun, Vacuuming Carbon Dioxide out of Thin Air, Adding Iron to the Ocean to Draw Greenhouse Gases Down to the Seafloor. And he said these technologies, up until a few years ago, designed to change the Earth's atmosphere, were considered too impractical, too expensive, too outlandish to be taken seriously, but now they're actually doing them. And they're causing so much trouble. I think, you know, Iowa, I talked to Steve King about them carbon capturing and trying to, you know, take farmland and grab people's personal property to capture this carbon. So it's gotten kind of ridiculous, and that's why this book is really timely and important. The Case for Realism.
Yeah, when you think about the academic world, it thrives on money coming from grants. And so much of this grant money right now is being pushed by these environmental agents or environmentalist advocates. And so it's to the professor's advantage to say, yeah, you know what? I think they have something here. And that way they get more money. What we talked about the media, that bad news equals good news for the media, but good news equals no news for the media. And what better way to sell papers than to scare people that the environment is about to implode?
Yeah, that's what Cal said. I think it's more, I guess I'd like to think it's that. I think I'd settle for a corrupted capitalism right now more than I would the agenda that I see going on, but I'll take that. Honey, thank you. This is interesting, and I hope people will enjoy this. And we do have a part one coming up. We're going to get into the religious implications of environmentalism and other things like that, so you won't want to miss it. So let me thank you for listening. I'm always happy when you listen to us and when you respond. We love to hear from you. Sandy@AFR.net is how you communicate with us by email. You can call us and leave a message at 662-821-2040. You can listen to the show on any podcast platform. You can go to sandyrios.com, that's the website, and listen pretty handily, or go to afr.net, which is, of course, our home base. Hey, thank you. Honey, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I think that this is something that really needs to be pushed back on. We have so many other problems that need addressing. This is not one of them.
I agree. Thank you, honey. All right, so I hope you enjoyed today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.